The following programming is sponsored by
MBC Media.
The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you.
Good afternoon, Philadelphia. Welcome back to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860. This is Gary Heasley in the studio. I've got with me online Ada Nestor. Ada, are you there?
I am. Happy Friday.
And happy Friday to you. And I'm glad that although you couldn't be here in the studio, I'm glad you are able to join us remotely.
It's going to be a fun show. Wouldn't want to miss it for anything.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And Joe, just to let folks know what we've got coming up today, we've got some new guests and we've got some returning guests. So we're going to start out at 12:30, revisiting a discussion with Chris Hinkle, our the gentleman who's given us tremendous insights into what's gone on with some of the activity we've heard around. We're going to talk about Kash Patel, and it's advantageous to be able to talk about this with Chris, who was a former special agent and a manager of undercover investigations. So looking forward to having this conversation with Chris, who has just been giving us tremendous insights. At 1 o'clock, we're going to have Emerald Robinson on. Now, you may know Emerald. She's been on Newsmax and One American News a lot. She hosts a show called The Absolute Truth. I did that show a couple of weeks ago. We're really excited to have Emerald on. She's brilliant, covers a lot of material. And then at 1:30, we're going to have a gentleman named Jonathan Butcher. Now, he's a new guest. We haven't had him before. But he's going to talk about what's going on with this DEI situation. What I mean is, now, Jonathan authored a book called Splintered: Critical Race Theory and the Progressive War on Truth. And what we've seen, as you know, over the last few years in every corporation, every school, everywhere you turn, is an endless march toward DEI, almost religiously invading and controlling the way we think and what we are allowed to say. And Jonathan's going to give us a little deeper insight into what's happening at companies like Microsoft and others who are in the midst of retreating on DEI. So is this real? Is it just a marketing ploy? What are we going to see? So I'm anxious to talk to Jonathan, who also works with the Heritage Foundation. So that's coming up in a little bit. But to start out the discussion today, Ada, I mean, trying to keep track of who Donald Trump is putting into his administration has become a full-time chore. This guy is moving so fast. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm enjoying watching the fire and fury from the Senate Republicans over all of these picks. The fodder that they are giving to left-leaning media right now is mind-blowing. And I think they're in for a really rude awakening. We elected Donald Trump, and we did that with an America First agenda in mind. And these senators voted for the most radical appointees in the Biden administration, and now they're clutching their pearls over Trump's nominees who are overly qualified.
Isn't it interesting? I mean, so you're telling me that somebody who voted to confirm Lloyd Austin is going to have a problem with Pete Hegseth? I mean,
right.
I recognize that if you're absorbed in the world of credentialism, right, that you think Anthony Fauci actually is a guy who's interested and knows how to save our lives because he's got the resume everyone else would dream of, until you dig into it and find out that that's not at all his goal. You think of these professors on campuses with multiple degrees who spout nothing but nonsense and yet consider themselves more intelligent and better educated than the average person on the street. Turns out they're not.
Nope.
If you're stuck in the world of credentialism, then you look at a guy like Lloyd Austin and you say, well, look, he was senior officer. You know, he was in the military his whole career. He's obviously qualified. Well, let's look at what he's done. You know,
right.
And one of the strangest things, we had a Keystone Town Hall last night, which was great, and just a great crowd. You know, the people there are just so fun because they know so much that it's not just a one-way conversation. It's really a community discussion. It is a true town hall. And so we were talking about this thing with Lloyd Austin. And of course, everybody remembers the story of the Secretary of Defense going AWOL. Now, if you're a lieutenant and go AWOL, if you're a private and go AWOL, you're going to the brig. This guy disappears for 2 weeks, doesn't tell anybody, doesn't make any preparations for his responsibilities to be cared for, and then shows up and says, oh, I was in the hospital. Well, okay, in the hospital, you're out of commission.
And his second in command was in Hawaii on vacation. So it's not like there was a command structure in place at that very moment. No, his second in command was on vacation.
Yeah, I mean, it's preposterous that we think that this guy is a good qualified general. Then you look at him introducing woke, weakening the culture of our military, making them less effective as a fighting force, the disasters that we've seen in Afghanistan and so on and so forth. I mean, this guy's been a catastrophe. So you're going to vote yes on that, no on Hegseth?
Yep.
And so, you know, some of these, like, give me an example of a senator that you were looking at who is given Trump a hard time but supported all these Biden people.
So I haven't heard where Susan Collins is on Kash Patel or Pete Hegseth, but I know that she has voted for every single one of Biden's nominees, and she votes to advance the judges. There are only five senators who have voted against Biden's nominees. That's Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, Rick Scott, Tom Cotton, and Tommy Tuberville. The rest of them have overwhelmingly supported Joe Biden's nominees. Joni Ernst is the one who's currently throwing a fit about Pete Hegseth, and she voted to confirm Lloyd Austin. I'm not sure she voted to confirm Blinken, but she voted to confirm a great many of Joe Biden's nominees. She voted to confirm Janet Yellen, Merrick Garland. Yeah. So these people who are supposed Republicans, who claim to be supportive of the America First agenda that won overwhelmingly in November, are now, you know, running around the halls of the Senate crying about the nominees. And I think that we should get out of the business of being the morality police. The people that they pick or confirm are horrible administrators of our government. They do not deserve the power that they've been given.
They do not. And so a Jody Ernst, who people think of as a patriot and as a conservative, it turns out if you look at her voting record, it's frequently problematic. And when you have a majority, you think, in the Senate, so you think that these nominees should just sail through, and then you find out that a number of senators are either going to use them for political leverage, or they're ideological, like Murkowski and Collins and McConnell, who just oppose the entire agenda. It's really frustrating. And the question then becomes, are the voters and the American people going to pay enough attention to what happens with these people like Murkowski and Collins and John Cornyn over the next 6 months to really understand whether they're standing with us or against us, and then to pressure them to join the American people in this endeavor to turn the country around, or to actually begin looking for someone to primary them in a couple of years whenever their terms are up? You know, because this idea that you get to the Senate and then you no longer have a responsibility to your constituents, this is an idea we ought to get rid of. We had one named Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania who frequently voted in a way that left his constituents incredibly frustrated. And eventually, of course, he had to just leave.
So I just want to go back. She voted to confirm Pete Buttigieg, who was a small town mayor, to be the Secretary of Transportation. Can we talk about his qualifications to be the Secretary of Transportation? Did he have any?
Well, he was a DEI hire. So, yes, he was perfectly qualified because he met a demographic goal that they set. But let's face it, he's been very effective as secretary. Oh, never mind. I mean, you know, you can't even fake it. You can't even make a joke out of it. This guy's been such a disaster and such a lunatic.
She also voted to confirm Janet Yellen. How do we feel about Janet Yellen?
Janet Yellen, who before she was confirmed, came out and said the role of the Treasury is no longer to make the economy stronger. That's no longer the primary goal. The primary goal now is changing our society to advance the woke agenda. She's, you know, if you go back and you look at things that Yellen said at the beginning of her tenure or before she was even confirmed, you'll find these kinds of statements where she talks about a new mission, a new purpose for Treasury. Well, listen, it's not Treasury's role to decide what society looks like. It's Treasury's role to serve the American people's economic interests. That to her was unimportant. And of course, if you listen to her, she's one of those people who are expert at using technical sounding terms that she strings together in unintelligible sentences to make it sound like what she's talking about is extraordinarily complex. And yet it's not. It's just that she makes it confusing and she, you know, can't really in a lucid, normal, straight way explain what she's doing or doesn't want to because what she's doing is nonsense. She's the master of transitory inflation. Remember, she was the one pushing that story. So when you look at these nominees, I mean, this is a unique bunch of people. It is really something. And we went through.
But they all have, have experience on the ground that the highly credentialed that we've been stuck with before may not have experienced. You know, Pete Hegseth has gotten his own boots dirty, has risked his own life, and understands the absolute catastrophe that our United States military is currently existing as and wants to fix it, loves it so much that he wants to come in and fix it. I mean, they're calling Tulsi Gabbard a security risk because she decided to find out what was going on in Syria herself. So that makes her Assad.
Bashar al-Assad.
Bashar al-Assad. I was combining the first and last, but suddenly that makes her a sympathizer to what their interests are. Or because she, you know, talks to Putin or his government, it makes her a sympathizer to Russia. So they think she can't keep state secrets. That is what the media is out there screaming about today, is that she can't keep state secrets. So how could we put her in that position? Well, we can put her in that position because the Biden administration and their government put her on a no-fly list because she was speaking up against what was going on in this administration. So, yeah, I think she has some firsthand knowledge as to how out of control our government has become.
Well, exactly. And you know, when she went to see Bashar al-Assad, I actually was encouraged because I thought it was interesting that a member of Congress was willing to go find out for themselves if what they were being told is true. And of course, if we paid attention, most of us know that what we were told about Syria at the time was in fact not true. You know, our allies were described as freedom fighters when they were really no different than the Taliban in many cases. They were a fractured group of different organizations that weren't cohesive. And the constant screeching about Bashar al-Assad was just based on the fact that he was on the other team, that he was aligned with Russia. And so for that reason, we should depose him and destroy his country. You know, there was never a lucid argument made about why we were going into Syria. And then, of course, people say, well, what about the red line and the chemical weapons? Listen, you know, there are Kurds all through the Middle East who have been our allies and some who aren't our allies. But using those chemical weapons never made sense. And I never heard to my satisfaction as just a normal person, enough confirmation of who actually used chemical weapons on whom.
Right.
Because it made no sense to me that the one thing that Bashar al-Assad had been told would bring in the United States was the one thing he went and did when it had no tactical or strategic advantage. You know, this is something we should talk about with Darren the next time we get him on the show and get his insights. Because, as you know, he's spent some time over there and he is, you know, a great resource for us in all things geopolitical. So there are some picks that Trump has put forward that are, you know, not exciting to me, let's say. So Lori Chavez de Ramer, the labor secretary, seems to me like, you know, a normal hardcore Democrat, sort of leftist labor person. She represented Oregon's fifth congressional district since 2022, and then lost a reelection bid, and now she's being considered. I don't know much about this woman. But when I hear a Democrat as a centrist, that just means they're less radical than Stalin in my mind, right?
Yeah, right. They're not radically progressive. Right. And just for everyone listening, if you are listening to this and you want to see Gary's pretty face and the awesome graphics that he has created for the show, you can go to TCVoiceWWDB on Twitter or X, and you can watch this broadcast live real quick. Sorry, go ahead.
That's a great point. So we'll see what happens with Chavez de Remer. And then there's, of course, one really important duo. We talked about this last night at the Keystone Town Hall, is Doug Burgum and Chris Wright. These are the Secretary of Interior nominee and the nominee for Secretary of Energy. And these two will have to work extremely closely together to achieve one of Trump's immediate policy agenda items, which is, of course, unleashing the full potential of our energy in this country. Now, we are producing a lot of energy. People forget this, right?
Yeah.
We are producing a lot of energy. The problem we have is that we aren't developing a lot of wells because regulations have become so onerous that that we just aren't producing enough new wells. So the wells that exist are being refracked, and a lot of them have been brought to completion and tapped, and they may have been drilled a couple of years ago but not used. But with these prices that we're seeing now, it's extraordinarily profitable to tap into the wells that are in place. But regulations, including environmental regulations, make it so hard to put new wells in the ground that side of the equation is missing. So as we move forward, and the wells that are currently there begin to play out, we don't have enough new well creation to keep the energy flowing. Burgum and Chris Wright, I'm not, you know, particularly, I haven't spent a lot of time on either of these people, but it sounds like two really good choices who are aligned in the mission of getting the United States back to low-cost, sustainable energy that is reliable and will fuel us having a global competitive advantage in manufacturing, allow us to reduce the cost of heating and cooling our homes and charging our cell phones. So I'm excited about these two guys. Any thoughts?
Well, I think that we're seeing the art of war from Donald Trump in live view. We get to see him pick people that may or may not end up being the final selection for these positions. They go through, forget the FBI vetting process. They go through the, you know, America First MAGA people's vetting process first before the FBI even gets close to them. And their skeletons are on the internet for the world to see within 48 hours. And that's giving them many more hours than they need. So we've already seen candidates or nominees being pulled down by Donald Trump because he nominated them and went on the internet 12 hours later and found out that maybe this person was not the right person for the job, it turned out. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think we're seeing a filtering process live and in real time.
Yeah, I think you're right. And when you contrast this, though, with term one, in term one, this process started later and took a lot longer.
He's financing this himself. He is financing the entire transition personally and is not taking any money from the government that way that they don't have their hands in it.
It's really interesting. You know, one of the things that he's already done is sent his emissary to the Middle East to begin talking to Israel and the Palestinians about Gaza. And that would not normally happen until sometime mid-February. Right?
Right.
At the earliest, at the very earliest. And now this guy's already over there, and he's over there on either his own dime or on Trump's dime. So he's free to go where he wishes to go. It's fascinating to watch this happen. Now, one of the folks that's been nominated is, of course, this Scott Bessent. And I'm just going to read a quick quote on Scott Bessent. He's expressed, this is out of the Epoch Times, he's expressed broad support for Trump's tariff plans, calling tariffs an amazing tool, but said these, including a universal 10 to 20% tariff and a 60 to 100% levy on Chinese goods, should be layered in gradually. Now, I agree with him. I think that these should be layered in very gradually. I would say from January 20th to, say, 90 or 120 days later, they should be layered in gradually over that period of time.
Yeah.
And we went through this last night at the town hall in some detail. When you think about the challenges that are facing us from an economic standpoint, when you think about the pressures that we are facing, you know, I don't think we fully understand them because a lot of them are not being represented properly in the statistics from the government. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has been wrong or faked the employment numbers for a long time.
Obscured.
Yeah, they clearly...
Did you see there was a huge adjustment just in October with unemployment?
Oh, yeah.
They had to adjust down the October numbers. Gee, I wonder why they lied about that in October. Was there something important happening in the beginning of November?
Well, remember, they grossly overstated the number of government jobs stated that month. But when you think about the risks to our economy, and I've got them up on the screen for those on X, China, lack of confidence, China's economy slowing... And when I say China is the competitor, right? You got this BRICS plus move where they're trying to move away from trading in dollars. You got the challenge of cutting spending, which while we must do it, it's essential. It also takes some of the flow out of the economy. Trade security risks. And what I mean by that is making ourselves vulnerable to, say, China. At one point, we produced no rare earths. We could not produce a fighter jet guidance system without China giving us the rare earths to produce those guidance systems. We do now, we're back in that game a little bit, but we're still not where we should be. Perpetual trade deficits, wages losing ground. We've talked many times about the numbers we use from the Heritage Foundation, that the median income in this country is somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000 to $79,000, and the median income has been impacted by about $8,000 in interest cost and inflation outstripping wage growth. So people are making the same or even a little more money, but have tremendously less money to take home. An $8,000 hit on a $79,000 median income is a big hit. The federal debt, perpetual deficits, the tax cuts expiring would be hugely impactful. And then the fake employment numbers. There's just a host of things that are affecting us that are real risks to the economy going forward. And I think Trump knows exactly what to do with each of them. I think he's got a plan for each of them, but it's not without its risks. And when I think about what he's got to do and do simultaneously, and again, I'm not going to go through all of this, but because we did last night, but it's an in-person two-hour discussion. When you think
which
about,
everyone can watch on the Conservative Voice WWDB on Twitter, you can rewatch the replay from last night's town hall to get that full conversation.
That's a great point. That's a great point. When you think about the factors that are driving inflation, you know, government regulation, the Fed and Treasury driving up or constantly injecting, printing more money. You've got government spending that's $2 trillion out of control. You know, these are real risks. You've got trade. We've talked about this endlessly. The employment pressures. If we actually begin to hear the real employment numbers, if they really adjust them all out, you know, we've talked often about this with Joel Griffith and from the Heritage Foundation. And there's a belief among a group of economists that there could be as many as 5 million jobs in our jobs numbers that aren't real. If those numbers start getting published accurately, it's going to be a real shock because people are now going to hear 5 million jobs lost, numbers that are staggering, right?
We'll just have to remind them that nothing's actually changed, though. It's been happening all along. So it's going to be a shock that the government's been lying to them. But, you know, we're still surviving. We're here.
Well, you make a great point. But the reality is that reminding, that's our job. Because corporate media is going to be exploiting this as hard as they can.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So we're going to have to do that. Then you got, of course, tax policy and energy that are imperatives. All of these issues have to be simultaneously addressed by the incoming administration, and they have to do it flawlessly. This is a staggering thing to try to take on. I mean, somebody just trying to address, say, employment and without worrying about regulation. The thing is, if you listen to Stephen Miller, America First Legal guy who was in Trump term one and is now going to be in Trump term two. He's like a MAGA animal, this guy. He's all over this. And he goes through the first 100-day plan and lays out things that address every one of those. He's just one of the people in this administration that understand these issues, that understand what has to be done. And as we can see right now, with the scale and scope of these appointments being made, the pace at which he's making them, replacing the ones that are coming out, we can see with the discussions that are having with him sending his envoy over to the Middle East. This team is not coming in ready to start thinking about what's got to be done. They know what has to be done, and they're coming in prepared to do it.
And you can see the posturing from other countries. You have Hezbollah backing down into a ceasefire deal. You have, I don't know if everyone saw it, but last night Tucker Carlson released an interview with, I guess, the defense minister of Russia, I believe, someone high up in the Russian government. And it was a lengthy conversation of which I listened to. And it seems very clear that they do not want to escalate this situation. They very clearly understand what January 20th means for them as well as for us. And that this election in America this year is global. Everyone is waiting for Donald Trump. Right. Everyone is waiting for his administration.
Let me read you a quote from last night. So this is an article in NDTV World News. And it's the headline is "Exhausted Ukrainian Troops Wait for Trump While Struggling to Hold Kursk." Now, for those that aren't aware, Ukrainian soldiers actually penetrated Russia and went into the Kursk Oblast, I think in August. And they've been there, and they've been hanging on, and it's remarkable they've done so because, I mean, this is really the stuff of heroism. This will be the Battle of the Bulge moment, right? This is incredible that they've been able to do this. But here's the quote from the article. "The soldiers are encumbered with fatigue and strained with sleeplessness because of terrifying 3,000-kilogram glide bombs. And now, as the winter stings, the only silver lining they can see amidst the gray, Donald Trump's inauguration."
Yeah.
"The soldiers laying in the mud in Kursk, fighting for their lives, are waiting for Donald Trump's inauguration. And that is why the Trump dance is the single most popular dance in pop culture today." Right? I mean, to your point, Ada, it is the world. It is the world.
It's the world.
We've heard people around the world saying we can never get our rights back if the United States falters. And they're right. And so it's, to me, it's just very exciting that this is happening. We do have a chance.
So many people are really behind it, right? We're not in 2017, January 2017, where half the country is terrified and really unsure of what a Donald Trump presidency is going to truly mean to the country or the world. It's 2024. We're heading into 2025. We know exactly what the world looks like without Donald Trump. We got a free trial for 4 years, and it looks like the majority of this country turned around and said, yeah, no, thank you. I don't want to upgrade to a paid subscription. And we get Donald Trump back. So I think there's a lot less fear going into January 20th than there was 8 years ago.
I think you're right. You know, I was talking to somebody, a very in tune guy, very smart guy, a couple of days ago, and we were talking about this, and he said, you know, we haven't saved the country by electing Donald Trump. That's not what we've done. What we've done is bought a 4-year opportunity to try to save the country.
Yeah.
And if we can be successful in these 4 years, then we can really turn things around and make the permanent changes that need to be made. And it's I think it's a very correct statement. When you think about what's got to happen now, if the American people say, listen, we've hired Superman, we can all go back to the Daily Planet and have coffee and bagels, we're going to fail. This country's going to fail. Donald Trump is the best qualified person. I don't think we had a plan B. We couldn't figure out a plan B heading into the election. I think this team he's putting together is tremendous. They're energized. They're already moving. But if the American people don't pay attention, it's going to be the Jody Ernsts and the Collins and the Murkowskis and the McConnells and the Romneys, the old establishment and the Republicans who are actually Democrats, as I call them, Republicrats, like Collins, Susan Collins. It's going to be those people who sit there and quietly undermine everything we're trying to do, everything this country needs done, everything those soldiers in Ukraine want to have happen, the Lindsey Grahams who want nothing but blood in those bloodlands. It's going to be them who quietly behind the scenes undermine everything that needs to be done. It's up to the American people to make sure that they don't have that freedom, that opportunity, because we need to be pressuring these elected officials, remind them that they're elected officials. And in the states where they live, they must begin looking for primary candidates to take them out.
Today, We need primary opponents today. We need to start building war chests today. We have 2 years before some of these senators are up for re-election. It's not outside of the realm of possibility that this time around, no matter how quiet or silently they undermine the mission of Donald Trump, we're going to find out, expose them, and we are going to make sure that when it comes primary season for every single one of them, they're gone.
That's right. That's right. So we're gonna shift gears here for a moment. We have on the line a guest of the show that's been on before, Chris Hinkle, who we introduced earlier. Chris, welcome to the Conservative Voice once again.
Thank you again for having me on. Always enjoy being here.
Yeah, glad to have you. And we've enjoyed getting your insights, which are unique given your background. So here we are looking at Kash Patel being appointed, but the build up to that has been quite dramatic, with Matt Gaetz being talked about and then taken out. Yeah.
And for DOJ.
For DOJ, but it's all connected, right?
And
they've been really concerned about that. Of course, Pam Bondi comes into the DOJ role, but she's talking much more about returning DOJ to focusing on law enforcement and focusing on their mission, rather than she is talking about DOJ being restructured, reoriented, reformed. So I'm concerned that with that change, we lost a bit of that momentum of reformation in the DOJ, taking it away from the political machine it is. And now they bring up Kash Patel, which is getting a terrible response from the left. They're in, I think, absolute panic. We've seen Andrew McCabe and others on TV yapping about this. And of course, anything Andrew McCabe is concerned about is probably good for the country, because I can't think of a worse traitor than him.
Seriously.
Oh, it's bad. But when you look at what the American public says, CNN put up a Gallup poll on screen the other day, and they showed Americans that believe the FBI is doing an excellent or good job. And those numbers went from 2014, it was 59% of Americans thought the FBI was doing a good job. 2019, it had dropped 2 points to 57. By 2022, it was 50. And now in 2024, only 41% of the American public believe that the FBI is doing a good job. Now, in our discussions, Chris, here, we talk about the 35s. It's about 35% of the country that believed Kamala Harris was a good vice president. It's about 35% of the country that believe whatever they're told. And if they were told to vote for a piece of driftwood pulled off the beach, they would vote for it. They're completely indoctrinated. So it's just a sliver more than the 35% that now look at the FBI as doing a good job. For you, I suspect this is a bit of a bad thing. I mean, you spent a career there. So can you tell us first a little bit about why you think the American public has gotten to this point? And then maybe we could talk about Kash Patel a little bit.
Well, I think a big part of it is the FBI has gotten a bit off track of in context of staying within the guardrails of the Constitution. That was always one thing from when I began in the FBI in the 90s. And in my small group of individuals that I rely upon for advice, fellow retired FBI agents, there's about four or five of us. I've mentioned this before. We call ourselves kind of the FBI Retired Justice League behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is reflective of the politics of the day. And a lot of that had to do with the establishment of the DEI and diversity programs and the elevation of individuals to positions of authority. So when I hear that the public has a distrust of the FBI, I caveat that to say that it has more to do with the actions of the executives up on the seventh floor in FBI headquarters, DOJ, and with the current administration than it has to do with the rank and file. I'm still in touch with a number of individuals still inside the FBI. They are looking forward to getting it back to its constitutional guardrails.
Mm-hmm. I have to imagine the doorbell ring cameras of the FBI agents going to people's homes about social media posts that then immediately end up on social media has probably not helped that percentage of people to have deep trust in the FBI right now, correct?
No, it doesn't. And that is one of the chief complaints, even from individuals that are former retired FBI agents that may be center left that I've had discussions with. You know, when I was growing up and when I was in when I first started in the FBI, when you closed your eyes and imagined what an FBI agent looked like, you looked for the person in the suit. Yeah. It just looked professional. And we got away from that, and nothing frustrates on both sides of the retirement community than to see these individuals in cargo pants, polo shirts, hiking boots coming up to engage in conversations. I had a number of debates with younger agents as they were coming in that would give me the idea of, well, I just want to kind of look like the person I'm talking to. No, you want to look your part so that you can come in with that respect. I've got four ideas primarily that's in an article I'm trying to finish right now.
Mm-hmm.
Recommendations for Kash Patel or whoever ends up being the FBI director. I initially was not, Kash Patel was not initially on my list, but I do think he might be the right person at the right time to come in and affect some structural change. And I just was in a text message with my good friend Jim Galliano, who is a retired hostage rescue team member, retired FBI supervisory special agent, current mayor of Cornwall on the Hudson up in New York. He's finishing up his term there. I think he would be ideal for a deputy director to come in and help Cash navigate the system. Jim is well respected in the community. But the four things that I would recommend, the first thing you've got to do, and I've heard a lot of talk about this, day one, Kash Patel should go in and immediately eliminate all diversity programs and DEI programs. There should be no measures in law enforcement dealing with immutable characteristics other than when you're investigating a violation of civil rights where someone is infringing upon those based on civil rights matters. But the DEI and diversity programs, and I was on the other side of that wall as a diversity program coordinator. I did that at the recommendation of one of my special agents in charge. And I got a look on the backside of it, and it's horrific. There are no measures that it shows of any improvement, and it has done things to cause problems inside the FBI. One of those problems, and I had some significant debate with some younger agents and support staff inside the FBI prior to retiring. We got to get out of the habit of promoting individuals with no investigative experience to run investigative divisions. There was a complaint among a lot of the diversity programs and the DEI people that analysts and support staff were not getting the high-paying, high-profile positions within the FBI, and that resulted in putting some people in place. There was a non-agent support staff member in the FBI that was an assistant director of the criminal division. No investigative experience. Had about 14 years as an analyst, you're not qualified to come in and do that, and it causes problems. So first, eliminate all the DEI and diversity programs. Second, reestablish the FBI's core values, what you're measured on. It's the values that I was measured on when I went before a review board. It's my last step prior to being hired as an FBI agent. None of those had to do with immutable characteristics. Remove diversity as one of those values.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing, reestablish the U.S. Constitution as the cornerstone of everything in the FBI, from physical fitness to investigations to even firearms training. Everything has to be within the constraints and the guardrails of that Constitution. And the last thing, and I think this should be a goal, and it can be done because it was done by Louis Freeh back in 1993, reduce FBI headquarters senior executive positions. You don't have to clean out entire FBI headquarters, as Cash had mentioned in a hyperbole, but reduce all FBI headquarters senior executive positions by 50%. In 1996, when the structure of the FBI was approved by then Attorney General, based on Louis Freeh's recommendations, there were 12 assistant directors in the FBI. They reported directly to the deputy director and the director of the FBI. We now have over 30, I think it's 33 or 34 divisions, assistant directors in the FBI who report to four or five executive assistant directors who report to a deputy assistant director, a deputy director, and the FBI director. The bureaucracy and the gap between the people in the field and the FBI director is, it causes problems, especially when you have individuals that aren't in direct contact with the field trying to manage investigations from Washington, D.C.
You know, that's an interesting. So when I hear what you're saying, of course, it all comes off as very, very logical, very common sense, and not at all specific to the FBI. These are the same four key points that you might roll out in any other group. If you think about the military, where we have a much smaller military than we had in World War II, but we have, I don't remember the numbers now, but a multiple of the number of generals, general staff, all the bureaucracy that's in there, all the outside consultants that aren't on the list of military personnel, but in fact do nothing but serve the military. These organizations have exploded over years as we have added up $36 trillion of debt to fund that explosion without going to the American public and saying, hey, listen, we need another, you know, $100 billion because we want to hire a bunch of administrators. It sounds like a very logical, very orderly thing. But when you're saying, you know, reduce the FBI executive positions, you said by 50%, that has to strike absolute fear in that building.
I would hope so. I would hope that people would look around and evaluate, you know, in the terms of the movie Office Space, you know, sit down with somebody and say, what would you say you do here? Because there are a number of positions up there that I think can be combined or eliminated. I think that would be a first step. But getting to your point of the military, I served for 13 years in the Air Force, served overseas, spent the last 5 years in the Air Force as a special agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And I can tell you what I see in from hearing the comments of fellow veterans and from people that might have in the past considered a career with the military. You know, the job of the military is to kill people and break things. That's it. I think Pete Hegseth is the right person for that job to bring back the lethality. So now the ideal person that you would want to join the military, that 6'1", 225-pound linebacker, Eagle Scout from your high school, looks at the military and all of these woke programs and emphasis on diversity and such, which has no benefit in a wartime environment. When they look at that, they go, I don't want to be a part of that. So they never even apply. The other thing is when you put people into combat, they need to be combat ready. If you have asthma, you're not combat ready. You're not going to be part of the Navy SEALs. You're not going to be part of special forces because you are a liability in the field.
Right.
If you are a male and you undergo this horrific surgery and have open wounds that have to constantly be treated, you're not deployable. You're not available to put out on the battlefield. And that puts us in jeopardy. It is a compromise of the integrity of the lethality that is needed in the U.S. military.
Are you suggesting that high heels and wigs don't work in a foxhole?
I'm stating that exactly. And I'll go even further, and I may be called a misogynist for this. Women do not belong in combat. Women do not belong in combat. There is no measure or anything that says that they would be beneficial to a combat situation.
Right. Well, I was talking about the men, of course, wearing high heels and wigs. Go ahead, Ada.
I'm a woman, and listen, if we get into some trouble here and you need someone in a foxhole, trust me, I'm going to be awesome in that foxhole with you. But I'm not going overseas to get in the foxhole where I don't belong with a bunch of men who do belong there. And I think that there are places for women in the military, and there are plenty of jobs that they can do and do very, very well. I don't think that in combat is where they should be. And I think actually that Senator Ernst's biggest complaint with Pete Hegseth, even though she won't say that, is that she is a woman who served in combat and doesn't agree with his assessment that women don't belong in combat. And she also supports.
Well, I'll say the thing out loud about Joni Ernst. And it's the same thing I would say about my Senator Roger Wicker. It has nothing to do with women in combat, has nothing to do with transgenders. It has to do with the protection of the money flow from the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely.
That's who they answer to. They don't listen to the citizens. I can tell you right now, Roger Wicker does not listen to the citizens in Mississippi, but we have no alternative right now. I think with the mandate that Trump has, I think things are ripe right now to start primarying a number of these individuals that have lost their desire to honor their oath and that they're more beholden to the donors rather than the citizens that elected them.
That primary process for all of these people should start immediately. I mean, it's overdue. While we're on the topic, though, let's turn to the Armed Forces Press, where Darren Gobb, friend of the show, is an editor, a writer, he just put this story up about New Zealand Navy ship sinks after struck by DEI higher torpedo, which I think is the best headline I've ever seen. New Zealand Navy's ship sinks after struck by DEI higher torpedo. When the New Zealand ship Manawanui ran aground in October 2024, the country of New Zealand saw $100 million sink beneath the waves. So this is the first naval vessel that's been lost by New Zealand since World War II. Also sunk was the continuing desire to engage in, quote, diversity hires, unquote. The ship was captained by a lesbian who was selected for the position because of her sexual identity rather than her merit. That's an article in America, or rather Armed Forces Press by Darren Gobb. This was an exact example of what we're talking about. I mean, this $100 million vessel goes to the bottom of the ocean because it was... It ran aground in a place where there are charts and, you know, you expect sailors to be able to navigate. It is then revealed that this woman was completely unqualified for the position. Imagine you are the person in the foxhole and the person next to you is a man who's gone through some conversion surgery and is wearing makeup. It would be a unique person who went through that kind of transition to be female who was then able to perform effectively in a foxhole. And I think just the same for a female that's tried to convert to being a male in their mind. This point of getting rid of the DEI hires or not the DEI hires, there are great people that are capable of doing all kinds of jobs who come from all kinds of places, but putting people in jobs they're unqualified for because it happens to fit this woke religion. This is crazy. And it's dangerous.
It's unfair to the people who are being put in those positions without the proper experience. You're setting them up to fail. You're setting them up to be disappointed in what they do because they're not qualified. So it's, you know, you're doing a disservice. DEI does a disservice to people who it elevates based on superficial terms.
That's right.
I totally agree. I mean, we just had that with the vice president. We just had that with the former Secret Service director. But it's not just the DEI hires. It's also that groupthink that still believes in that diversity, equity, inclusion. And I would say that the current acting director of U.S. Secret Service is a horrific example of incompetence at the helm of that. I watched him arguing with the people's representative. And trying to, you know, bloviate, to make himself look like more than he is. We have to remember, and I tried to point this out when they elevated him, just like when they elevated, disgraced FBI agent Andrew McCabe to the acting director position. You got, when Kash Patel, if he's confirmed, and I think he will be,
I do too.
When he comes in, you can't, when Director Ray leaves, you can't have the deputy director elevated. You've got to really clean out that seventh floor. He has to come in and put people in position that are going to do the things that the people want, not just what Trump wants, what the people want. And then one thing I want to stress to people, I hear news pundits say this all the time, talking about the independence of the FBI. It's not an independent agency. It's a component of the executive branch. The president has the authority to walk over to the FBI and say, close this investigation, open this investigation, do this. He has the authority to do that. The 10-year limitation on an FBI director was just to say that this is the max you can serve. It was done as a knee-jerk reaction after J. Edgar Hoover spent 48 years as FBI director. That's the reason it was done there. It wasn't done just to say, we want to have someone that can span multiple administrations. Mm-hmm. It was done to place a limit on that. And at any point, the president can say, you're done. You're out of here. He doesn't have to have a reason. And I can't imagine Chris Wray wanting to suffer the humiliation once he's fired on January 20th. He will be fired on January 20th. I would almost put money on
it. I agree.
But he will likely resign before then, and he'll go into some high-dollar consulting job.
Are there really 7,000 people at FBI headquarters? Is that a real number?
Easily that many. Now, not all of them are agents. There's way more support staff at FBI headquarters. And the phrase that, and some of my fellow retirees will understand this, the support staff runs FBI headquarters. Mm-hmm. They will just wait you out. A lot of them are there for 30, 40 years. Heck, we had a secretary that was she retired as the assistant director's in charge as secretary in Washington field office. And she spent 68 years in the FBI. She spanned Hoover all the way up to when she retired in the early 2000s.
Wow.
Millie Parsons was her name. You can look her up. She served the longest in the FBI. But the support staff generally runs that. Now, when I talk about senior executive positions, that's going to include support staff as well. Mm-hmm. And you need to restructure and have people that are in positions that they are unqualified and not experienced in holding, such as being a deputy assistant director within the criminal division. They will say, well, they're only over the intel collection portion. I will tell you this, and it upset some support staff when I was in the FBI. There is a difference between an intel analyst and a special agent. Mm-hmm. And the primary difference is the intel analyst doesn't have a badge and a gun, doesn't have the field experience of going out and conducting the investigation and doing all of those things. And this is blunt. It's the reason I have my moniker on X, at BF Conservative, Blunt Force Conservative. Here's a blunt force truth. There is nothing a support staff inside the FBI can do that a special agent can't do. But support staff can't do everything that a special agent does.
Mm-hmm.
It's two different wheelhouses. It's the same thing I've told attorneys when I've done their background investigations or when I've had casual conversations with them. There is an entire difference between direct, redirect, cross, and recross examination in a courtroom and conducting an investigative interview or interrogation. Two different skill sets. So you need to understand, as I told one of the support staff that was mad at me for saying that, I said, you have every opportunity to be exactly where I am now. You just need to go through that same path and apply to be an agent and work your way up. But just because you're on the support side doesn't mean that we give you all of the benefits of having been an agent inside the FBI.
So we've got about 2 minutes left or 3 minutes left. Can you tell us, I mean, what is the reaction now inside? I'm not talking about the bureaucracy anymore, right? Now we're talking about the actual FBI community, the agents, the people that really are in there for the right reasons. How do they look at the possibility of a Kash Patel director?
The ones that I've talked to are excited about getting back to focus on the things that I observed when I came into the FBI in the 90s. And that is working and conducting investigations. I think you also have to have that. They're looking forward to an emphasis of being able to work what's called your domain in the field, rather than having FBI headquarters tell you what you're supposed to be focused on. You look around, you liaisons, you work with, you develop partnerships, you develop a tripwires and source network in your community so that you know what you need to protect. And because of this focus from the headquarters that started under Robert Mueller, we've gotten away from that. I can tell you the FBI rarely does anything on bank robberies anymore. There's a lot of things that we were investigating when I first got down to Jackson, Mississippi as a supervisor that we just don't do anymore. And we collect the data on it, but we really don't respond to the bank robberies like we do. That is a great liaison opportunity to work with the locals. It was awesome working with our state and local partners when I managed one of the programs was my bank robbery program. So they are excited about it. They're excited about getting back within the guardrails of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. They're excited about going out and having someone not knee-jerk when they tell them that they work for the FBI.
Yeah, that it's just got to be demoralizing to see the reaction you get when when an agent goes out into the community and is no longer treated with the kind of respect that that the agency got forever. I mean, in these last few decades anyway. I mean, I don't know what it was like when...
Yeah, it's disrespect to the agents in the field, the tarnishment on the badge that these executives have done. The agents in the field are fantastic. They are great at doing their jobs. They do amazing things. It's being obfuscated by all these miscreants at 500 Pennsylvania Avenue.
So just to run down your list again, if I got these right, it's eliminate all DEI programs within the FBI. It is experienced investigators must run investigation divisions. Reestablish the U.S. Constitution as the cornerstone of everything in the FBI. And then reduce the FBI senior executive positions, including all senior executive positions, by 50%. Chris, we're running...
That'd be a great start.
And we will post all of your social media links. We frequently repost your posts. Thank you so much for joining us on The Conservative Voice.
Thank you.
Ada, we'll be back in just a few minutes. Folks, if you're listening, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll talk to you in just a couple of moments.